Okay, let's go to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. We started into a content outline and did the introduction, verses 1 through 11, and now we're ready for page 3 in our notes. Start off by two stars, and basically the entire following part of the book revolves about the search for the chief end of life. And the first thing that the section, or the first sermon, will revolve about will be search for the chief end of life, and it is by means of personal experiment that will be the stress. First sermon stresses personal experiment on the part of Solomon, and it takes in 1:12 through 2:26. And basically, there'll be two experiments. First of all, will be the wisdom experiment in chapter 1, and then in chapter 2 will be the pleasure experiment. We're ready to look at the wisdom experiment, and basically that will break then into two parts. Is we have, first of all, something about the pursuit. And that's in verses 12, 13, and 14 of chapter 1. Remember the perspective of the book. Apart from God, what's the chief end of life? And he's going to say it's all futile apart from that. So verse 12 of chapter 1. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and to explore by wisdom. It's going to be the wisdom experiment, and notice it's personal that's involved. Solomon is going to try it himself. I set my mind to seek and to explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. So notice you have the pursuit, and it is followed by, inevitable, the disappointment. The disappointment comes in, really, in verse 14, but extends to 18. And notice the first summary emphasis. And, you know, if we would say that any of us have made a personal experiment in life to see whether the chief end is wisdom, what would disqualify most of us? Most of us would be disqualified because we probably have never done what Solomon did in verse 13. Really, set our minds to seek and to explore, and if we had, we couldn't say what he said in verse 14. I have seen all the works which have been under the sun. So that the, of course, the added thing that Solomon had a special gift of wisdom from God. So notice he makes the pursuit, he finds the disappointment. The disappointment is expressed in verse 14 in all is vanity. I don't think we noted, did we, this morning, that that little word is so much on Solomon's mind that it will occur about 37 times throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is saturated with futility, with emptiness. Now, why is it that this pursuit of wisdom, why was it so empty? Why was it disappointing? Well, I take it, it's because of two concepts. One in verse 15 is that no matter how wise you get or how far you go, there's still something that just eludes you. There's still something in all your wisdom that you just can't put together. You notice many times that the more educated a person gets, the more wisdom they get, the more understanding they get, the more they say, I pursued it so far, but you know there's still a mystery out here that I just can't get hold of. And notice how he kind of reflects that in verse 15. What is crooked can be straightened. I pursued wisdom, and I see some crooked things out there, but you can't straighten them. And what is lacking can't be counted. In other words, there's a link there that just seems to elude. So the things that are there to be counted, what do I say? They're missing. Missing link is the emphasis. And I take it with the disappointment, is the idea, is he's saying in verse 15, there was always a missing link. There is always something you can't put together that just doesn't fall in place. And he says that's the end of wisdom. Now keep in mind, this is not wisdom derived from God's viewpoint. This is wisdom pursued without divine viewpoint or without the Word. Then he also notes a pragmatic thing, and that's in verse 18, that the increase of wisdom doesn't equal increase in happiness, verse 18, but in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. We perhaps should have tonight said that the language students are not welcome for this session, and high school and grade school students are not welcome for this session because it might get misused in verse 18. But keep in mind the perspective of the bird. There's nothing wrong with pursuing, with thinking, with striving, with studying, provided we have it in the right framework. And he is saying that in verse 18, out of human wisdom you get happiness. And he says it simply is not there. There's only grief and pain that is multiplied with it. Now you stop and think. And if we'd classify people on the high school, BS level, BA level, MA level, PhD level, what correspondence do you see between internal satisfaction and happiness as you move up the scale educationally or as you're down the scale educationally? See, this is what Psalm is looking at. Here's a person below the BA level. And would you counsel them that if you get a college education, you would certainly ensure yourself a good deal more happiness? And if you'd like to get a little more, get an MA, because MAs are happier than BAs. And then if you really want to have it put together and guarantee that you'll really have happiness, by all means get a PhD, because PhDs are consistently happier and more satisfied with life, and they have found the real end of life than others. As a matter of fact, from the perspective of Scripture, doesn't it often seem that the PhD is the one that is the most mixed up in terms of divine viewpoint realities? And this is what Solomon is driving at in this particular context, is that it's not equal, that type thing. So, from the wisdom pursuit, which is in chapter 1, he then shifts, and you can see the shift very dramatically in chapter 2. He now goes to, let's try the pleasure experiment. After he does that, he'll put the two side by side and make a comparison. So 2, 1 through 11 is the pleasure experiment. Now again, I think when we look at verse 1, and Solomon says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself. Keep in mind what we said earlier this morning. Keep in mind the resources that Solomon had to entertain himself with. As we said this morning, our resources for enjoy yourself are highly limited, are they not? A yacht would be very enjoyable, I think. But I have a limitation on a yacht. Do you? And the limitation is dollar bills. Keep in mind, we're looking at a man that knew none of this limitation. And consequently, if anybody says pleasure doesn't satisfy, this man's got to be an authority, because he had the means to test it out and try all of it. So that our limitation is very simple. Pleasure means dollar bills. Pleasure that he's talking about costs money. Now let's tie that in with 2:10 to notice that he didn't have any limitations. I don't know that anybody could have ever said anything like this. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. Wouldn't that be fantastic? Well, I guess. Seems like it. Whatever you see is yours. Why do sometimes women go window shopping? Why don't you just go regular shopping, and if you see it, get it if you want it? And you know the obvious limitations, at least some women hopefully do. Try to marry one that does. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. But he didn't have to. There was no limitation. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was a reward for all my labor. So the idea is I've worked hard, and having worked hard, I'm going to reward myself. I put in my time, I put in my effort, now I'm going to collect the reward for it, and I'm going to collect the reward in terms of rewarding myself with pleasure. So this sets up a very common pattern, which is going to be, I want. Next, I get. Next, I am still unfulfilled. That's exactly what Solomon is going to say he went through. I wanted it. There was no limitation, so I got it. Once I got it, I summarize it with what word? Still vanity. Still empty. Still does not satisfy. Do you recognize the pattern? We have no problems back here with the want. Wanters are in abundance, and they could want just about anything, legal, illegal, moral, immoral, whatever. Wanters are enormous, have capacity. Many times what we wanted, we got. with the expectation that this will really bring fulfillment in life, and after a while we find out that I'm still unfulfilled. Now, fools that we are, when we go through this, what do? We go back and do it again, don't we? We just change the object of the want, and we say, well, I missed it on that round, but let me see if I can put something else in my menagerie. And now I want that, and that will do it, and we get that, and pretty soon we find we're unfulfilled, and what do? Fools that we are. We start the whole routine over again, and many, many lives are spent simply on this basis, and they come up and say, I'm empty. I'm still not fulfilled. And this is the wisdom that comes across from Solomon. This is the normal, common human pattern. Now, what is this saying? This is basically saying, I tried to summarize it in a summary statement. It's simply this. There is no capacity for genuine enjoyment for a man whose life is not centered in God. He cannot want and get enough to ever come to a point of satisfaction. Now, notice some of the details coming down in chapter 2, verse 3. And the first thing I want us to notice about the details is notice how many of the things that he had are perfectly legitimate. Not a thing wrong with them. Coming down now to verse 4. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. What is there inherently evil about that? Nothing, is there? It's talking about a good thing if you can afford it. I built houses for myself, and he could afford them. I planted vineyards. Those are all decent things. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted them, all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water. As a matter of fact, I think we can go further than that. Where did Solomon get all of these blessings of wealth? Didn't he get them from God? See, even material blessings from God in themselves don't cut it. And so he comes down and he has these ponds of water in verse 6. Verse 8, I collected for myself silver and gold, the treasure of kings and province. I provided for myself male and female singers, pleasures of men, many concubines. We're getting a little bit illegitimate there, but many a man's mind has gone in that direction, is in the conquering of many females, there is a great satisfaction in life. And so verse 9, then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood with me. And then about all that his eyes saw. And then notice he concludes down in verse 11. I consider all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I exerted. Behold, it was all was. And then we're back to that repeated word 37 times. It was all empty and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So let's bring another couple of principles out of that. Happiness is the capacity to handle prosperity and abundance as well. Let's put it down as true happiness or true satisfaction is the capacity. It's not a thing, it's a capacity to handle prosperity and lack of prosperity equally well. And when we got that, see, most men only develop the capacity, supposedly, to handle prosperity. Notice that stated very clearly in Philippians 4 and verse 12. Paul had it. Chapter 4, verse 12. Notice he had developed the capacity to have a prosperous time, and he also had the capacity not to. Verse 12, I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. Which means Paul could drive the finest or the least. That was, and it's not the idea that he didn't wasn't able to enjoy a great deal of prosperity. But notice, you have real, in fact, maybe we should change the word happiness there to the word contentment, true contentment in life, is capacity to handle prosperity and to handle the lack of prosperity both equally well, Philippians. So, could we put it a different way? Placing Christ at the center of life rewards the believer by doing what? Giving us dual capacity. Capacity to handle prosperity, capacity to handle adversity. And that's a very, very important lesson coming out of Ecclesiastes. Okay, now let's go back once again to chapter 2 and ask another question. When you look at the blessings in terms of works and material possessions that Solomon had in this particular passage, then how are we going to distinguish this from chapter 13 of Genesis? And let's read it and compare. Real capacity means I prospered and had a beautiful house and I enjoyed buying it and living in it. Now I can't have it, and I did what when I sold it? I wept? No. I enjoyed buying it, I enjoyed living in it, and I enjoyed selling it, which is the emphasis of the great capacity that's there. Now, how are we going to distinguish, however, the emptiness that Solomon gets from the fact that God obviously in the Old Testament gives material prosperity that's evidence of his blessing? You can hardly deny that many times in the Old Testament there'll be flocks and sheep and herds which the Lord had given. Now, how do you distinguish between those? Such as in chapter 13 of Genesis, we've got another man that was very rich and had lots of prosperity. Verse 1, so Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him and Lot with him. Now, Abraham was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. And you can't help but take that back to the Abrahamic covenant. God had promised to bless him, and he blessed him with many of these things that are listed here in this area. Now, verse 5, Lot, who went with Abraham, also had flocks and herds and tents. As a matter of fact, verse 6, they were so wealthy that the land could not sustain them while driving leather, for the possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. How did Abraham get those possessions? Well, he got them as the blessing of God. Well, how come it is that you have him enjoying his prosperity and you have Solomon sitting back and saying, I got all these things and it's all empty and it's all futile? Well, we've listed them out here, I think, on the sheet in the simple observation down at the bottom of page 3, which is Abraham centered his life in God, therefore had the capacity for great prosperity. Solomon centered his life in things and therefore had only the capacity for misery. So notice the emphasis is strictly on where the center of life is as to whether or not we have capacity to enjoy these particular things. All right, back now to Ecclesiastes 2. In chapter 2, verses 13 down through, about verse 23, he's going to go back and he's going to compare the two things, and he's going to compare being a fool and being wise, and he's going to come to the conclusion, the fool dies, the wise die, therefore there's no difference between the two. Then you have, in verse 24, the conclusion of his first sermon. Let's simply read the conclusion. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and to drink and to tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that is from the hand of God. Now you get a little glimmer of divine viewpoint here of what we've been talking about. For who can eat and have enjoyment without him? Now there's the thrust, that the capacity for enjoyment is not there. You can't eat and enjoy dinner. You cannot drink and enjoy the drink without him, is the emphasis. And that is the glimmer of divine view. That's not the thrust per se of the book, but Solomon is beginning to come in with some of this. And notice he concludes the chapter with his final sentence, this also is emptiness and striving after wind. All right, that moves us then into our second sermon. Notice how all this is revolved about personal experiment. Now, second sermon, or page 4 of the notes. Now, this time we're going to move a little bit away from the personal experiment angle of things that he tried, and the emphasis now will be in this sermon on personal observation. Or we could put it this way. The first sermon is things I have done and found to lead to emptiness. Now it's things I have seen and observed that lead to emphasis. And it's going to revolve about three things. The first one that he's going to deal with is he seems to take in the first 15 chapter the viewpoint that everything in life seems to be fixed. Everything in life is fixed. In this chapter, he'll deal with about three of the philosophical problems that men come across. And the first one is, everything seems to be all lined up and all fixed. Whatever will be, que sera, sera is the idea. Or the idea of fatalism or the idea of determinism. Now, when we come to chapter 3, that chapter, I think, has been painfully misinterpreted in that the typical interpretation of chapter 3 is that there is an appropriate time for everything. Isn't that the way you've usually heard this one used? Coming to verse 2, there's a time to give birth, a time to die. And the meaning intended is there's an appropriate time to give birth, there's an appropriate time to die, an appropriate time to tear down, appropriate time to build up. I don't think that's the... In fact, I think if we're thinking of Solomon saying there is an appropriate time for everything, we'll miss everything. He's not saying there's an appropriate time. He's saying everything is fixed. Now, why do we say that? Well, first of all, begin reading in 3. There is an... Now, option. Appointed or appropriate? Appointed time. As a matter of fact, if you look up the Hebrew word zaman, the first lexical meaning is quote, to be fixed. Not to be appropriate, to be fixed. So there is a fixed time for everyone. He's talking about fatalism. He's talking about determinism is the idea. And therefore, verse 2, there is a fixed time to give birth, a fixed time to die, a fixed time to plant, a fixed time to uproot what is planted, and so forth, on through the whole context. So he's complaining about everything in life seems to be locked in. This is the idea of sort of a fatalism. Look down at verse 14. Even in his relationship to God, he seems to have a fatalistic, depressive, despairing type thing. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it. There is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. In other words, God has fixed everything, so we'll come to fear him. That which is has been already. And that which will be has already been, for God seeks what has passed by. So the emphasis is on determinism and a fatalism that Solomon is wrestling with in this particular context. Now, from that, in 16 through 22, he deals with the second universal that troubles him. First of all, everything seems fixed, and now everyone dies. 16 through 22. Now, granted, Solomon is telling the truth. Everyone does die, and we can't deny that. But his conclusions are the false ones, and they'll come down about verse 18. I said to myself, concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men is the fate of beasts is the same. One dies, so does the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast. All is emptiness. All go to the same place and so forth, and that same place is physical death. Now, is it true that everyone dies? Yes, it is, but the conclusions are false. One of the dangers in exercising the mind thoroughly is it will see the right thing and come to the wrong conclusion. And that's exactly what Solomon does. He observes and he sees the right thing. Everybody dies. That's true. Then what's he do? He takes the correct information and then goes off into an incorrect conclusion drawn of it. So the every creature dying is the... what's his conclusion? Down at verse 22. I've seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. In other words, in the light of the fact that you're going to die, live for time. There's his conclusion. Everyone dies, therefore, conclusion, live for time. And that's not a good conclusion. The third thing that he sees and is really bothered with is everything is filled with injustice. Everything in life is filled with injustice. And he has that in chapter 4, verses 1 through 16. And we won't have to read but just a few verses in a chapter 4, and you'll get that. Let me ask for the conclusion now. Is Solomon taking a pessimistic view of life? Is this a book of pessimism? Or let me ask you, is he being real? I see a lot of realism here. Do you see it in chapter 4? Then I looked at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. Now, that's not happy, but hey, that's real, isn't it? And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them, and on the side of the oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. That's a little bit despair. Better off than both of them is the one who had never existed. Better to be dead than alive, but better than that it would be to have never been around at all. Better off than both of them is the one who's never existed, who's never seen the evil activities done under the sun. And therefore he emphasizes that this world is filled with all kinds of rivalry, with all kinds of jealousy, and he is very concerned about the injustice. So what are the problems then? We've got them in those. He's dealing with the problem of determination. This sort of philosophical section. Problem of determinism, everything seems to be fixed. The problem of dying, everybody goes to the same place, and the problem that injustice really does exist. And he concludes at the end, this is therefore empty. And that moves to his third sermon. Now, basically in his third sermon, he's going to say, look, there's lots of injustice in this life, and therefore the best thing to do is to strike some kind of medium and practice the best personal morality that you can. And I would key off of this section from chapter 7. I believe it's verse 1. I would suggest 7:1 is a key. Now, in the midst of all this injustice and unfairness, what would I suggest to you? Well, I'd suggest this, that basically a good name is better than good ointment. In other words, let's work at maintaining in front of people a good reputation in this life. However, that does have problems. Verse 15, and this is again as part of the futility he comes to. This good name is so important, and yet on the other hand, how about verse 15? I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. Is that real or is that pessimistic? You ever see righteous people that never seem to get anything fair out of life? I can understand that. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. And there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. I've seen the righteous die still righteous, and I've seen the wicked go on living in their wickedness. So, or even down at verse 21, some of the hang-ups that are involved in just trying to maintain a good name. Also, do not take seriously all words which are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For you also realize that you likewise have many times cursed others. So the thrust in this, again, is just if you can maintain a good name, that is probably the best thing that you can probably try to do. Now, beginning in this sermon, you begin to get a little hint that you don't have previously. Look, for example, at 7:13. This is not all that strong, but you're beginning to get a note come into the context a little heavier, and that's some mention of God. 7:13. Consider the work of God. Okay, now that's a little bit of a new tone. Verse 14, in the day of prosperity be happy, but in the day of adversity consider, God has made one as well as the other. So we're beginning to get a little bit of God into the context. Verse 18, it is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other, for the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. And that's a note now for the third time that's beginning to come into the context. Chapter 8, verse 12. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that will be well for those who fear God. So we're getting a little bit of a note in here we have not had previously. Verse 13. But it will not be well for the evil man, and how he will not lengthen his days like a shadow, because he does not fear God. And then in 17, and I saw every work of God, and concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun, and so forth. So notice you do have pretty heavy here, five or six times, a little note that you don't have in the first part of the book of Ecclesiastes, and a little hint that maybe God ought to be included in the picture. Now that brings us to the final message, the search for the end of life, and basically it's made up of a review and a conclusion. And I'm not going to spell all that out except to give it to you. His fundamental argument comes in 9:2. It is the same for all. That's fundamental to Ecclesiastes. So, in view of the fact that wise or a fool, pleasure seeker or not, it's the same for all. All come out of the same place. In the light of that, therefore, true good is not pleasure. Ecclesiastes 9:3-12. True good is not wisdom. 9:13-18. True good is not simply morality or good behavior. Chapter 10 and chapter 11. Alright, now let's close out in Ecclesiastes by doing a few things with it in terms of perspective. First of all, is the book of Ecclesiastes pure pessimism? And by the way, on these three things, on pessimism, skepticism, or inspiration, what I'm dealing with is many of those that have used the book of Ecclesiastes says all it teaches is pessimism on life. Then there are those that come along and say, well, the book is just loaded with skepticism. And then there are even believers who come along and seem to put something unspiritual with the book of Ecclesiastes. And I like to address each one of those. First of all, is it pessimism? The way you've got to get it is not to take a verse and a verse and a verse. If you do that, it's pessimism. How about what we read in chapter 4? I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living, but better off are those that have never lived. Now you pull that out, and that's pessimism. That's morbid pessimism. But that's a mistake. That is only a part of Ecclesiastes. That is not the entire message. For example, in Ecclesiastes, to balance out the pessimistic part, does he expect some future justice? Look at chapter 3, verse 17. Pessimism just sees life as one unfolding horrible thing. He's not that way. How about 3:17? I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man. So he's anticipating a righteous judgment at the hands of God. 12:14, in his concluding part, he comes down to the end, because God will bring every act to judgment. Everything that is hidden, whether it's good and evil. Is that pessimistic? That's a very optimistic note. So don't take the book to be pessimistic just on the basis of a few dark shadows. We also ought to add that people, I think, today tend to say that if you're trying to deal with where things really are, you're pessimistic. Have you sensed that today? If you try to say, look, we are in real trouble, someone comes and says, well, that's a gloomy view. Hey, maybe it's real. Maybe it's a realistic view. And I think a lot of the pessimism that Solomon's accused of is really realism. Okay, how about the skepticism? The criticism usually comes around the idea that the book of Ecclesiastes is skeptical about life after death, and the passage used is 3, down about verse 19. Is he really saying that the death of an animal is no different than the death of man? Is he really saying that? Well, in verse 17, I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man. Doesn't that anticipate life after death? And when you go to verse 20, all go, that means beast and man are the same place. Isn't that only referring to physical death? All come from the dust and all return to the dust. Now what about verse 21? Who knows the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward? So notice he is not really assigning the destiny of both to be the same, is he? He's seeing the spirit of man go one place and the breath of the beast to go another, opposite directions. And he also posits a judgment afterward. So I take it that it's not so much skepticism that's involved in the book. All right, whenever we get these apparently contradictory passages in Ecclesiastes, let me suggest three things to do with them. Number one, whenever you look at one verse in the book of Ecclesiastes, view each verse in light of the final conclusion. View every verse in the light of the final conclusion. The final conclusion is chapter 12. Chapter 12 gives final conclusion, such as remember now the Creator in the days of thy youth. So remember everything in the light of the final conclusion. And then keep in mind that many of these verses are viewed as man under the sun. And that little expression we did not deal with us, but under the sun is the idea of man in his earthly existence apart from God. And then third, keep in mind in Ecclesiastes the nature of inspiration of Scripture. Namely, it records lies. Now, a few principles. The first one is, isn't Ecclesiastes re-emphasizing the teaching of the following New Testament passages? Number one, Matthew chapter 6. Isn't Ecclesiastes restating the principles in these three passages? Matthew 6, verse 19. And having looked at Ecclesiastes, these things ought to carry a lot more weight now. Verse 19 of Matthew 6. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. You think Solomon would agree with that? You bet he would. This is exactly what he's saying. Don't make this your treasure house. But, in the contrast, lay up yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth or rust destroys and where their thieves do not break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And couldn't you take that text and go back to Ecclesiastes and say, boy, is that ever true about laying up treasures on earth? Colossians 3, 2. Principles we're trying to emphasize from this. The first one is it emphasizes the New Testament set of priorities by telling why we shouldn't have our mind on these things, because they're disappointing. Okay, Colossians 3:2, which reads, set your mind on things above, not on things that are on earth. Can you tell from Ecclesiastes why? Because all these things are futile. 1 John chapter 2, 15. 1 John 2:15. Do not love the world, nor the things that are in the world. Can you think of a reason from the book of Song of the book of Ecclesiastes why? They're disappointing. The lust of the eyes, boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but from the world. And the world is what? Passing away. That's part of the term vanity, is the idea of passing away. So, Ecclesiastes re-emphasizes New Testament priorities. Now, I don't know whether you like this combination of words or not. Doesn't the book of Ecclesiastes tell us something about sensible resignation? to the realities of life? I don't know whether the phrase there, sensible resignation, is a good one or not. But don't you learn in life that there are certain realities out there that you might as well resign yourself to? Is there such a thing as a sensible resignation to certain realities of life? Is there injustice in this world? Is that realistic? Are you going to change it? Isn't there something to be said that there is sin in this world and we're going to have to live with it? And that is the reality that we live in a sinful universe, and as such we're going to see injustice and wrong all about us. As a matter of fact, are we going to be the personal victims of unfair treatment in this life? Or are we always going to get a fair shake? Well, by golly, I'm going to see that I get one. You want to approach life? Does that make sense? So help me, I will get treated fairly. So help me, God, or I'll get an ulcer seeing that I get treated fairly. Now, again, if you get taken at the grocery store, take the stuff back and say, you know, it's spoiled. I'm not talking about that. But if you're going to fight it all the way through life of insisting at every point along the line, I will be treated fairly, so help me God, what's the realist going to say about that? And isn't there a little sensible resignation that is involved in it? As a matter of fact, isn't that what we're coming up with in Romans chapter 12 on Wednesday evening? About when you're wrong, what are you supposed to do? And the emphasis will be that when we're wrong, as we will be, our responsibility is for a correct divine viewpoint response, not try to set everything right. Okay, now let me give in closing. That takes too long to write these out. But let me give you the 10 vanities, because there are 10 things that he specifically calls vanity in the book of Ecclesiastes. Number one, in 2:15 and 16, is vanity number one, the vanity of human wisdom. I'll put arrow out here. Why is it an empty thing? His argument is that the same end for the fool and the wise is death. He'll label each one of these things a vanity or an emptiness. 2:19-21 will be the vanity of human labor. You know what his conclusion is going to be? I'll go through all of this work and be successful. I'll leave it to my kid, and he'll be a stupid fool with it. So I'll go through all of this, and the kids will squander it. Give birth to a fool. Does that ever happen? And that's what he's looking at. He says, doggone, I put all this work in, I give it to this kid, and he blows the whole thing and acts like a fool with what I worked on. So what's the use of it? That's a vanity. All right, 2:26. And we ought to take a look at that. We're going to do a little bit of explaining on that. This is going to be the vanity of what I'll just call human purpose. Now, the thought involved in this is simply this, is that you will work and gain something, gather and collect it, and then you know what will happen? God will turn around and give it to somebody else. You meant it for yourself, and it goes in a different direction. Verse 26, for to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he is given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he, God, may give to one what is good in God's sight. The idea is no matter what you do and what you purpose, is that God will distribute it. Or, as it often put, man proposes, God disposes. If you read that verse several times, I think you'll see that. Man proposes, God disposes. Solomon apparently doesn't like that too well. I work for it, I get it, and then God takes it and he distributes over here, and I don't like that kind of redistribution of my wealth. Vanity. 4:4. We have a system, I won't say what it is, for redistribution. that sort of thing, but four-fourths. Basically, in 4-4, he's talking about the futility of human competition. And what he's complaining about in that particular area of human contribution is when you compete and you succeed, what do you get from everybody? Appreciation or envy? Be real now. You win, and what do you get rewarded with? You get rewarded with envy. And that's in 4-4. I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is, and he labels it, pebble or vanity. 4, 6, and 7 is the vanity of human greed, avarice. And the idea would be, you get much, and what, when you get much, what does that feed? Much feeds the desire for more. So much feeds lust for more. That's wisely stated in 4-6, sort of in a proverb. One hand full of rest is better than 2/5 full of labor and striving after wind. In other words, it's better to have less than it is to have more. And therefore, he takes the one hand is better than having 2 hands full. And I take it his idea is that that's your human greed to get, I want 2 handfuls, is simply saying that I've got much over here, but I'd like to have something, I'd like to have more. And it tends to feed the lust for more. 4:13-16 talks about the vanity of human fame. And the emphasis there is you get famous, and his complaint there is it's very soon forgotten. Another generation comes along and says, Solomon who? Hey, where are some of the great world conquerors of history? Do you know them? And when you have to read about them in school, you're kind of aggravated because, well, I have to study about Ashur-hazar Hashbaz or something like that. And the famous is gone. It's brief. It's soon forgotten. The vanity of human, and I don't know of another word to use, insatiety, means you just want more and more and more. It can't get filled up. That's in 5:10 where he says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Or he who loves abundance with his income, this too is emptiness. So the insatiety emphasis there. Then in 6:9, the vanity of coveting. And that's cleverly put. It's the idea that so many things you want so bad, and you get them, and then you can't enjoy them. You know, it's the old man who wants the young girl, and he gets her, and he's too old to enjoy her. Seven, six, and yet the desire goes on, but the performance is not there. 7:6 talks about the emptiness of so much humor and frivolity that men practice. 7:6 says, for as the crackling pot of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. This also, and there's another futility emphasis coming in. And so the idea that the crackling of the fire under the pot, it only conceals the sad end of it all. Then in 8:10 and 8:14, you have the final thing that he points to, is the vanity of human awards. What about working for human awards? Suppose you fix your mind on that. Look at 8:10 for closing. So then I have seen the wicked buried, those that used to go in and out from the holy place, and they are soon forgotten in the city where they did thus, this too is futility. Verse 14, this is futility which is done on the earth, that is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. the emphasis that here's a righteous man, and how did he get rewarded? Like the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say this is a futility. So the emphasis is in, if we're going to work in life for reward and award, he says that's futile. Because I'm seeing the guy over there getting the medal, and the medal belonged over here. Or I see this guy getting the reward, and it belongs over here. Have you been out in the world long enough to see any of that futility? You work and work and work, and really you do the best job, and who gets the promo? The next guy that'll be working all week. Therefore, how much sense does it make to guard and guide our lives around these futilities? And therefore, your final conclusion is to center life in the Lord. Those, again, I just give them as a listing. You can deal with them, but they are the futilities listed in the book of Ecclesiastes. You know, next Sunday we'll move to the divided kingdom, and we'll see what begins to happen after the fall of the kingdom into two separate parts. We'll look at kings of Judah, and then we'll look at kings of Israel down to their fall. Father, we're thankful today once again for your word, and we pray that we'll realize it's born and inbred into every one of us here tonight. It's the same pattern that was born and bred into Solomon, and we take the same pursuits and the same things, and then we get disappointed and we say, what's happened? Things didn't turn out fairly. May we recognize this is a sinful world and this is part of it. And therefore, what you're saying to us is that it is not so much looking for justice in this life as it is you're saying to us, when these things happen, here is the way I want you to respond. And therefore, as we come into that study on Wednesday on our reaction to the book of Romans, may we grow in grace and in knowledge of you through this. In Christ's name.